Hello, everyone. A little bit of an unorthodox episode of Getting Hammered today. After this, you're going to hear an interview with my friend Carol Markowitz. I am in Israel, and I have been in the north of the country and in the south of the country, in kibbutzim on both borders, speaking with IDF reservists, speaking with survivors of the attacks in Kfar Aza, down in the south of Israel, speaking with a survivor of the Nova Music Festival massacre. And so it will not be a light episode, but Carol and I have a brief discussion, and then we have a couple clips from a man who is living in Kfar Aza. He is the only person who has returned to that kibbutz with the hope of showing others that they also can return and maybe live a normal life. There are, of course, soldiers there as well to provide security. I also spoke with Yoni Diller, who tells his whole story of his day at the Nova Festival. And it doesn't get too gruesome. It's not extremely graphic, but it is an arc of his entire day, starting at about 4 a.m. when he arrives at that festival. So I thought you guys might want to hear it in his own words. And so we talk a little bit about it, Carol and I, and then I'll hand it off to him and I'll let him tell the whole story. It is heavy to witness, but also important to remember the stakes. And as always in Israel, I am struck by the existential nature of the threats, the determination of the people to win and survive and be resilient because they have no other choice. And it makes me feel stronger even about standing with them as they do that. So again, a bit of a different episode, but I hope you enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Getting Hammered. This one coming to you from Israel. We're in Tel Aviv. I am with my good friend Carol Markowitz, who's a writer for the New York Post. You've seen her everywhere. You've read her book, Stolen Youth, or you better have, because I did a whole podcast on it. And if you haven't, you should still get it. Carol, how are you doing?
I like that bossy intro.
Very good. You got to tell the people what's good for them, Carol.
Yes, that's right. You got to tell them what they need to do.
So we are in Israel together with a group of journalists.
Yeah.
And obviously, Israel heavily in the news since October 7th. We've covered extensively on Getting Hammered. But being in the country always gives mm-hmm. different perspective. And I wonder, do you have two big takeaways that shifted at all once you got here? Anything that you changed for you?
I have to say that I think I was naive on what was going on in the north. I think I saw them as, okay, yes, I heard they were more powerful. You know, Hezbollah in the north and in Lebanon was more powerful than Hamas in Gaza. Yes, I knew that. But really hearing it, like, seriously beaten into me this week, how bad it is, how powerful their missiles are, especially when compared to Hamas's missiles, how they can reach Israeli cities, how they might be able to reach Tel Aviv, it really put a point on it. And the fact that 80,000 people have been evacuated from their homes in the north, that's all I've been thinking about. I've been thinking about that a lot. It's when, you know, you and I have talked about this, but when and how do they go home? Yeah. When do they feel safe enough and secure enough and protected enough that they go home? And I don't know what the answer to that is. So that's been a revelation.
Context, we were up at the north of the country near the border with Lebanon. There are kibbutzim up there, just as there are in the south, and they are mostly uninhabited at this point, except, you know, being sort of patrolled by IDF, mm-hmm. Which has a large presence up there, because every day after October 7th, citizens and government and army alike assumed that there would be a similar raid or something launched across that border.
Yeah.
It did not come, and that's one of the questions we keep asking, why didn't it come?
Yeah.
But because people were evacuated to protect them because of the surprise of October 7th and fears that would happen again, they are now all displaced in the middle of the country going on 5 months at this point.
Right. And you know, you had this great analogy. It was like closing schools during COVID. Like, when do you feel safe enough to reopen them? You just never really hit that point where you're 100% safe. And you know, obviously the backdrop to this is a little bit, people have lost some faith in the army to protect them. It used to be, oh, the army will take care of it, the army will protect us. And now, obviously, that's a little bit questionable. The other thing that I feel like I maybe knew was happening, but it really also was brought home to me, was how the divisions that Israel had for the last, you know, year plus before October 7th, where they were arguing about judicial, you know, changes, I think a lot of that is still simmering underneath. And I see, if you go to Hostage Square, it's very powerful, it's very moving, the exhibits and the families, you see the friction between even the hostage families who say a deal at any cost, and they have signs like no deal equals hostage death, or the hostage families that are saying, no, we have to finish this war. I can't have the deaths of my family members and my hostage family members, you know, time in captivity be in vain. We need to win. So I feel like Israel is going to come to a head on that. And that's a tough, tough call, because obviously if I'm the hostage family, I want them home at any cost. But you can't do that.
I always find, so I've only been to Israel twice, but both times I felt I was affected by just the mere proximity of everything. And mm-hmm. I think unless you are here, it is hard to grasp how perilous a situation is for the free people of this country.
Yeah.
This one, like, pluralistic island of a democracy in this region of the world. And it's, on one hand, very scary, but on the other hand, hopeful, because what people will tell you and what the reservist up at the north said is, we will win because we have no choice.
We have no choice. It has been the line in Israel. Absolutely nowhere else to go, nothing else to do. They have to win. So yeah, that's, you know, it's hopeful. You got nowhere else to go, so you're going to have to beat
the
bad
guys. You just got to win,
right,
so you got to win.
And that's it.
But it truly feels like, when thinking about all this displaced population from the south and the north, and how you get back to that, and how you win a military victory while you're doing that, and then how you fight a PR front as well that's, like, you know, incredibly unfriendly to Israel on the international stage, and unfortunately from the U.S. getting unfriendlier by the day, it all piles up into something very daunting. We got the chance to go down to the south, and we saw Kfar Aza, which is one of the kibbutzim that was hit very, very hard. That was, I mean, I expected it to be heavy, and of course it was very sobering and horrific to imagine in this beautiful place. I mean, the birds are chirping.
The air smells so fresh.
It smells amazing. The flowers are blooming everywhere, purple, like bougainvillea and all these gorgeous tropical flowers. And to imagine the horror and to see the leftovers of it.
Right. That first
jarring.
This one house that's open to visitors, the mom of the girl that died there, who was 23, wants people to see it. And it's riddled with bullets. It's they're all over the door, all over the walls, all over the ceiling. And it's like they had to kill these two 23-year-olds so badly. They shot this many bullets into the house. And it makes no sense. It's an enemy that you cannot negotiate with. You cannot talk to people who desperately needed to kill this 23-year-old couple that they, you know, riddled their house with bullets.
I was struck by they had photos. It's set up sort of like a very, very gut-wrenching but mini museum. Mm-hmm. So you have pictures of the place as it was once, particularly of the bedrooms, sort of set up how it was at one point. And then you see what became of it in the interim in pictures as well. And then you see the little bit more cleaned up version, because this is, you know, this is cleaned up from some of the savagery that was there and the carnage that was there. But you see the pictures of that and the blood spatters on the walls and what that really looked like when more like what it looked like when her mother came to see it the first time. And just there's also on the wall, they laminated the last texts between her and her mother, which is just
crushing.
So much of that is so awful to think about, those conversations going back and forth.
Right. It was really hard. And then the Nova Festival, we went to the site of the Nova Festival, and obviously that was, there's just no words. There's no words from mowing down 20-something-year-olds who came to dance, and it's really tough. I didn't, you know, you and I both have kids, and they're heading into the teenage years, and sometime they're going to be like, I'm going to a music festival, and we're going to say yes, and we're not going to think about paragliders and, you know, the enemy across the border, and we're lucky.
Yeah. We spoke to actually a survivor of the Novo Music Festival. His name is Yoni Diller, and he actually talked about, and I'll play a clip of him, but he actually talked about his parents having a conversation with him the night before this festival, saying, "Why are you going to these silly festivals? Mm-hmm. These are a waste of your time.
Yeah.
Don't do this," because he had been going for a couple of years. And I think he, in fact, said that his brother, he told his brother to tell his parents that he was going up north. So they didn't know until later that he had been there, because he didn't want to have a fight with them about going to the festival. And he manages to escape by sort of keeping luck and keeping
and
guided by God, he said, but keeping his wits about him and trying to figure out a direction he could go that would not be into danger.
Right. He has a story where he runs into a girl named Shawnee who had been shot, and she ends up waiting for an ambulance, and you know, unfortunately she ends up dying, but he says that she saved his life because he saw the direction she was coming from, and he heard bullets from the other direction, and then he saw missiles from the other direction, so he went in the only direction that made any sense, and it was saved,
and ended up walking 4 or 5 hours to another community, at which point, by the way, and this just to imagine the horrors of that day, once he and his friends, this small group, get to this community, they have to prove they're Israeli and not terrorists, lest they be attacked due to some misunderstanding. So he ends up being able to get out that way. But he has, since that time, retold his story over and over again at American universities to people in government, both here and in America. And he goes back to the site of this horrific event and has been back, I think he said 3 or 4 times at this point, but he says that feeling that discomfort is sort of part of his medicine.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence, I think, of like facing your demons is a good thing and not hiding from it. But I don't know. I couldn't watch the movie, the 47-minute compilation that they put together of all the atrocities of that day. They showed it, and I really couldn't sit through it. And I don't know that I could go back to a site where I saw people die. Even if I know that that's the right thing to do for my
family. No, it's a very tough ask to come face to face with that and be in that place. Being in that place, I wasn't at that event, and it was very moving for me to see flags flying and the faces of all these young people and all their sort of sweet Instagram perfect young faces, and the idea that you would look at that a killing field, that you would look at that as too many people in our country do, and I know it's like a minority, but they're very loud.
They're loud, yeah.
And they're also young, right? That you would look at fellow young people in that situation and think, their country should stop fighting on their behalf.
Right.
I can't
fathom
it. Or
they deserve this.
I cannot fathom it.
They deserve this because they were too close to another country that hates them.
Right.
You know, that I feel like we hear that a lot. It's like, but they were in their own country.
Right. It goes beyond don't fight for them. It goes into
maybe they deserve
blame them.
It. Right.
Ugh.
It's awful.
It's very. This is not the most uplifting episode we've ever done.
No, I feel like, Carol. I mean, you and I can be funny together. But this is a serious one. This is a very special episode, and sometimes you have to be serious.
No, it is the contrast between being there and then, you know, we'll go out to eat in Tel Aviv tonight.
Right.
And
we went to this like amazing restaurant during the day today.
Right. They're
Malka.
Amazing restaurants, amazing food, people enjoying themselves, which is
the beach.
I don't know who said it on this trip, but someone said that the suffering comes with the territory of being a Jew, but so does the resilience.
Yeah.
Right? The community knows nothing else than, well, you didn't kill us all, and here we go. We keep going forward.
Yes.
And you feel that in the country to a great degree.
Absolutely. I think it's such a resilient country. I know I have fears about where they're going, but I know they're going to make it.
Yeah. Party that we done, and in the forest, 500 meters from here. We sat there until the middle of the night. We drank, we eat, and then we came back. We threw all the dishes in the kitchen and go to sleep. We wake up in 6:30 in the morning before, and we drink our coffee outside. And in 6:30, it started to be crazy. And we never go inside the safe room because it takes 7 seconds. I am too heavy to run, and so it's only if it's one or two, I prefer not to move. but it started to be crazy. It was 100 missiles in the air, Iron Dome, a lot of noise. We decide we get inside the safe room, we close everything, and very, very fast, very fast, we understand that they got terrorists in the kibbutz, but we didn't know the numbers. And I mean, the terrorists can arrive. The army come in no time, and finish the problem. After 15 minutes after 7, I got a phone from my neighbor that stay in the place that we have the party to keep to watch on the stuff that left there. And he asked me if I can find his wife because she doesn't answer the phone. His wife is a next door neighbor to my house. And, I understand that they got a tourist inside. I took a pocket knife with me and go to look after. I found it a few minutes after she been murdered. And I get inside back to my house and I say to my wife, it's much more serious that we thought you going under the bed, and I hold the handle, because the handle is the situation. If you hold it, you're much stronger than the people that try to open it. All the times that they don't shoot on the door, you're in a good situation. To my house, no one get in. So.
Is your house on like the edge of the kibbutz or something?
No, it's the middle of the kibbutz.
Is that just luck, or is there a reason?
A lot of houses they didn't get in. A lot of houses they get. Yeah, it's luck. Yeah. And we understand that they got terrorists, so it's very, for me, I have to understand what happened. So my wife inside, I go outside. החייל הראשון שתראה שם זה של צהר. The next time that I go outside, I see a three terrorists walk with the backs to me. I saw that IDF because they're in the same
uniform.
And I almost called them. And then they want to make a turn, and I see his weapon, so I understand that he's not from our side. So I go inside.
Oh, you recognized it as a weapon that the IDF doesn't
been
use.
A few years in the
right,
army.
Right.
I tell my wife again, so serious, I saw three, so probably they have more. We didn't understand that they got hundreds of terrorists with a weapon here. And after they arrive in the first wave, there come a lot of people just to rape and to lishdod.
Loot.
Yes. To steal, to do whatever they want, and that's what they do. They kidnap, they kill, they loot.
So first the Hamas, like, you know, guerrillas came, and then the civilians came.
Yeah, and then the civilians start to go back, and the Hamas stay. And you have to understand, the last terrorists that kill here, kill in the 11. 4 days after the event.
Yeah. The army still wasn't here?
No, he was here. He was fighting. Oh. The last soldier was killed here, killed in the 10. The last terrorist killed in the 11. But most of the soldiers killed in the 7 and in the 8. Because then was hundreds of terrorists with weapon. And in the beginning, the army didn't understand what happened. So he sent everyone. So a lot of good unit. But small unit arrive, and they arrive 9 people, 5 people, and they met a lot of terrorists that killed them.
And nobody here had any guns or anything.
We have a civil defense that did it, between 11 to 12 people, from what I know. And they fought bravely. and 7 of them get killed, and 3 or 4 get wounded. So you can't do much if you are 11 and 100 of weapon shoot on you. So they got a lot of free time to do what they want. And you can see the situation in the kibbutz. This is only a small part which go along, and we see things inside the kibbutz. This is a normal place. It's a normal life in a non-normal place right now. But we hope that people see that we live here.
So are you living here?
Yeah, I live here for the last 3 months. We came back in the 10th of December. And we hope that people see that it's impossible to live here and start to come back. And that's what we hope. And until now, it doesn't work so well. Mm-hmm. But in a few months, the school will finish. And people will start to...
Hopefully return.
Hope school start to come back.
So, October 7th, I was supposed to come here to the Nova. I came here together with a friend. I arrived around 4 in the morning. That Friday night dinner, that was exactly the Friday night dinner where my parents told me, I don't need these festivals, it's a waste of time. There's not really any, there's no point to go to these festivals. We had this big discussion. And I decided that I'm going. I've been going to these festivals for the last years. It's fun. What I do mostly is I come as a photographer, more like with the drones. I like drones as a hobby. And I haven't brought my friend with me. So we arrived around 4 a.m. The event started already late at night, already midnight. And we joined a group of friends. We were like over 20 people. We arrived around 4 a.m. We joined a group of people. We're like 20 of us, plus minus, somewhere around there. And at 6 o'clock, I told my friends, let's go and dance. Let's have a good time. So we went to dance there in the dance floor. So imagine us arriving at 4 a.m., us wanting to go start dancing around 6. 6:30 is when everything started. As the sunrise when the sun was rising up, and we saw, sunrise there in the east, then we saw hundreds of missiles coming our way at the same time. In the beginning, I was sure I was dreaming, because I look at the sun, I see all the rockets, and I look at my friend, and I'm like, people are still dancing, because people can't hear the sirens. Mm-hmm. It's an open field, and the sirens usually are in the cities, whether it's Sderot, Kfar Aza. And after like a minute or two, the police took the mic, told everyone, guys, there's an alarm, there's Seva Adom, the red alarm. Take your stuff and leave. But before that, take cover. Now, you can't really take cover in this place, so the best thing we could do is just, put our head down and be on the ground. And we saw the really, there's no point in just standing here. So we just took our stuff and left. So what I did, I took my friend, we went to help our friends to wrap up all the camp, and we start heading outside.
So people were camping here?
A bunch of camps, hundreds of tents here. There were over 3,000 people in this festival, all right? Some people were panicking, some people were panicking less, a lot of drama. Anthony likes to say all the time, no time for drama. This woman saved my life. I'll get to her in a second. We start going out, but there again, there were 3,000 people trying to get out. There's a lot of traffic and everything. People are honking, panicking, people are stressed, and we're trying to head out. There's too much traffic. So I just suggested maybe we should take the other road, going south, going to Reim. It's going to Be'eri, towards Tel Aviv, is where everyone is going. So I thought maybe it could be an alternative way. Might be easier. So we went south, and again, there was traffic. Now, these times where there's a lot of traffic, so much traffic, you just stop the car, you get out, and you're trying to see like what's going on. That's where we were. People were shouting at us, do a U-turn, do U-turn now. And frankly, I didn't really understand what's all fuss about it? There's just rockets coming our way. Now, unfortunately, here in Israel, already used to this reality. You know, it's not the first time we see rockets. Honestly, I'm not sure if I was really afraid. I was kind of like, wow, this is like a once in a lifetime. You're in a festival, there's rockets. Okay, you take cover, it's gonna pass. That's usually what happens. This was a different scenario. While we're heading south, everyone stopped. But there was one incident, one thing that really triggered. There was this car coming our way, really slowly. It was kind of, it was driving without any too much drive, but it was very suspicious. As it got closer and closer, we saw bullets in the car, full of bullets. And you see this girl, Shani Gabai, in the car, trying to get out. She stops the car. She bumps into the car on the side of the road. She gets out of the car. We help her get out of the car. Well, she physically can't because she was shot on her left knee, on top of her left knee here. We help her get out. She can't even cry. She can't even, you know, show any feelings because she's just
shot.
She was shot. She was injured. Now at that time she wasn't really severely injured. We tried to cover her wound, give her water. But we did everything we could at that time to just help her out. But that's when we understood, okay, this is not just rockets, there's something going on. The last thing I thought is a terrorist invasion. Okay, I just thought maybe it's a part of a missile that somehow mishit, maybe it's IDF, somehow there was a mistake. So we helped her out. My friend was going to give her water. Before he even got back, we heard gunfire. Automatic gunfire coming from Be'eri. Now I served as a combat fighter in special forces in the IDF for 3 years, and I know how gunfire of IDF sounds like. I know what doesn't sound like IDF. So it was automatic gunfire, one after another from the north. And as time went by, it became stronger and louder. So imagine the situation where you see an injured girl coming from this side in the south, and you hear gunfire from the north, and there's hundreds of missiles in the west coming from Gaza. My intuition said, okay, the best thing we could do is just go east, go to the open fields where you've probably seen these videos of people running in the open fields. Well, that's where we were. We were just running in the open fields and trying to find shelter. So we found this, we left our car there, everything, the gear, just me and my friend. And
so it wasn't drivable?
No, the open fields, you couldn't really drive there. There's just this big road there. So people that were, people just running, you know, everywhere. We were in the valley, we're hiding. Everything was pretty calm, pretty chill. A few minutes later, the gunfire started getting closer and closer. And then you see bullets flying over your head. You see bullets flying over your head, and like, okay, this thing is real. Our life is in danger. My friend Adav calls his mom, his sister, his siblings, tell him he's fine, and trying to not make him panic. Me, honestly, I didn't tell anyone. I didn't tell my friends or my parents. I didn't tell my parents, my friends, anyone that I'm there. I didn't want to panic at everyone. There wasn't really time to think. Okay, you're in survival mode. You're putting your head down and you're just wishing for everything to be okay. My friends and everyone was just split in different places. So bullets were flying on top of our head. We're all like, everyone's like really scared. We start heading east. I wasn't sure if that's the right way. I just opened my maps and I see different villages around the area, and I see this place called Patish. It's a small moshav. In kilometers, it's like 24 kilometers from where we were, which is, I don't know, 16 miles, I guess, 15, 16 miles, which is quite far. So we start walking towards Patish. Us and another group of other dozens of people just walking east towards Patish. We weren't sure if that's the right place to go, but for sure it's better to go there than just stay here. People are here shot to death like in a duck range, whether it's in open fields, but kept staying here. Now We kept walking to Patish for more than 4 hours. Almost 5 hours, we were walking with no food, no water, not knowing what exactly we're doing. We're just trying to pass the time and wishing for hope. Eventually, we arrived. People are drinking from water from where it's... The water that people are drinking just to survive is water that is... It's filtered water from the sewage that is meant for agriculture. My friend found grapefruit in the middle of the fields, and everywhere, like 90% of all the grapefruits were bad. And somehow we could have just... We just kept walking and walking. We arrived to Patish. The civilians helped us. They came with their cars. But imagine us, you know, dozens of Israelis coming towards Patish, and there's all this news breaking on. They're probably thinking we're terrorists. Yeah. How can they know? We could have been shot by them because they thought of maybe we're in there, like we're the danger. So they yelled at us, like, you know, show us like who you are. You know, like waqif, waqif, and all that in Arabic. We said, we're Israeli, we're with you. And they saved us, they took their cars, and they brought us to their community center. They gave us something to eat, to drink. We were saved. But while we were walking, all that's happening here is like a complete massacre. Over 360 people died, were murdered in cold blood here. Four of my friends died. Shani, she was here, waiting for the ambulance to get her back, because there was an ambulance here that was going to get people, and Shani was together with the cops. There was like a container here with the policemen, and she was just waiting for someone to help her out, you know, to bring her to the hospital. And there wasn't too much room in the ambulance. There was just room for people that are severely injured, that are almost dying. Shani was, she could wait for another round, but she was here. And when the ambulance went to Soroka, to Be'er Sheva, to bring all the injured, it got an RPG hit by one of the Hamas terrorists. So all the people in the ambulance got murdered. And Shani, you know, she was waiting for this ambulance, and it was just devastated. So all the people that kept staying here were just fired, and they were shot. And so Shani was one of them, and she's one of the reasons that actually saved my life. So it's important for me to always share her part of the story as well. And
of course.
And she's a big part of it. And
you together just learned
with
her name.
Huh?
You just learned her name, right? You gave her water, learned her name, and then she said like she's gonna wait for the ambulance, and you took off.
Right? Yeah, we did everything. We were like 12 people around her, giving her water, yeah, blocking her wound, taking our belts from her, just to, you know, and make sure everything's, she's gonna be okay. And
is she still a hostage?
What?
Is she still a hostage, or?
The thing with Shani, she, we thought she was kidnapped for the first few weeks.
Yes.
Yeah, but after less than 2 weeks,
on Instagram, I said she,
you know,
was
what
kidnapped.
Happened? Yes. They found one of her necklace, another person's, yes, body, while he was buried. And they found Shani's necklace or something of her, yes, DNA in her body, meaning she was burned alive.
I know the story.
Here. So it's really, really sad. This is my story. You know, I'm doing everything I can to share this. Again, there are hundreds of other people that, you know, survived this massacre. And there are people that survived things that are much tougher. Tougher stories. Ugly stories. And what I did from this point onwards, I just did a lot of advocacy work, speaking the truth, speaking against anti-Semitism. On October 8th, I went to IDF as a reservist, a miluim, reservist?
Reservist,
as miluim. My commander asked me, Yoni, like, where were you? I was at the Nova, and I was really fine. And I was like, you know, where can you sign for a weapon and everything? And he said, look, let me give you an answer, just give me a few hours, I'll let you know. And I said, like, I didn't really understand what's the problem, because I was very eager to fight, you know. Everyone had this big energy, you know, just to do something, this whole nation. And the last thing I wanted to do is stay home and, you know, listen to the news. So I went to the IDF, and then my commander told me, my captain, he said, look, Yoni,
we'll call you when we need you. Right now, we have enough people. And it was true. But I have another, I think he just wanted me to just, you know, settle, just relax until I feel ready to come back. I was so upset that I just wanted to do something.